Hi, well, the Society Library has kindly allowed me to say a few words about the book history colloquium before we get to introducing tonight's speaker and on with the program. Tonight's event is co-sponsored with the New York Society Library, where you all are, of course, but also part of the Book History Colloquium at Columbia, which is run out of the Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Columbia. I am Carla Nielsen, curator for literature at the RBML and curator of that series. I want to let you all know that if you are interested in other events about the long history of books and reading, we go all the way back to the classical period, and our most recent talk was on electronic books. Feel free to let me know, and I'll add you to the Book History Colloquium reading list. Columbia also has a full program of exhibits and other talks, and I can also add you to our general mailing list, so just let me know after the talk. Our last talk in the series this spring will be on April 16th, and doctoral student in English at Columbia, Lindsay Van Tyne, will be presenting on some fold-out maps of Columbus's voyages in the early 19th century editions of Washington Irving's accounts of those voyages. So that should be a really interesting talk that might be of interest to you. And that will be at 6 p.m. In Butler Library at Columbia University. And if, again, let me know if you want to make sure you receive advance notice of that. I also just want to say that we are delighted to be co-sponsoring tonight's talk with the New York Society Library and to be presenting Professor Grafton. Both Professor Grafton and the New York Society Library have done so much to advance the field of book history over the past many decades. Professor Grafton, of course, through all of his scholarship and not just scholarly writing, but popular writing on the interest of books and the importance of libraries. And the New York Society Library for being so open to working with both very new and seasoned book historians on things such as the Readers Making Their Mark exhibits, and also their fantastic digitization of their circulation ledgers from the late 18th centuries. That's a really amazing resource for historians of the book. So we're really thrilled to be co-sponsoring with the New York Society Library, and I will now let Aaron Schreiner introduce Professor Grafton.
Hi, everyone, and welcome. Thank you all for coming. I'm honored to introduce our speaker tonight, Professor Anthony Grafton. This is a tall order indeed, but I think it's a safe place to begin by saying that the Society Library has hosted Professor Grafton, albeit with some long absences, since he was a college student. The Graftons lived here in the neighborhood, and Tony took advantage of his family's household membership and read his first 16th century book in this very building. This is just a fact that completely delights me. Since 1975, Professor Grafton has been a member of the history department at Princeton University. Since 2000, he has been the Henry Putnam University professor. He has published numerous books on the cultural history of the Renaissance, which you can see on display over to my right, and writes regularly for the New York and the London reviews of books. He published The Footnote, A Curious History in 1997, and most recently in 2012, The Culture of Correction in Renaissance Europe. Professor Grafton is perhaps best known as a pioneer in the field of book history, and especially for his attention to the practices of scholarship and reading. Writing on Grafton in 2012, Anne Blair described his working methods this way. He paid close attention to the citation and claims of the participants themselves, rather than rely on historians' truisms, and attended to sources that often had been left aside, notably manuscript notes, collations, and marginal annotations in printed books. By showing how those sources were themselves enmeshed within their authors' intellectual, personal, and institutional circumstances, Grafton created a portrait of classical scholarship in action from the mid-15th to the mid-17th century, and generated an expansive model for an intellectual history encompassing practices in addition to ideas. As you may have noticed, the Society Library has been especially inspired by his attentions to the annotations in the margins of books. We invite you all to take a close look at the exhibition outside in the Paluzzo Family Exhibition Gallery, Readers Make Their Mark, Annotated Books at the New York Society Library when the talk is through. We are delighted and honored to host Professor Grafton this evening. Thanks.
Thank you all for that lovely welcome, and thank you, Erin, for that really lovely introduction. We actually joined the Society Library sometime after 1962, probably around 1963 or 4. And in those somewhat different days, what I chiefly remember was the lively group of high school students who filled the reading room on Saturdays, rather different from the reading room now, since there were no internets in which to do the research for one's term papers. And so the massed inhabitants of Brerley and Spence and Trinity and Collegiate and other high schools were to be seen here fighting over the Society Library's holdings and using them to very good effect. And certainly in my case, it proved infectious and has kept me doing this for a lifetime. Now, I have one tremendously disappointing confession to make at the beginning. There will be no barrels tonight. When I started preparing this lecture, which is about people in the colonial Americas reading books that connect them with the very faraway lands of England and the continent where most of them were printed, and as we'll see, these are books that really made emotional connections for them with the continent, I knew from studying the continental world that books are shipped in barrels in the pre-modern world. You know, the worst thing that can happen to books is that they get wet. Barrels are your most watertight shipping means. And here you see a 16th century gentleman lugubriously putting books into barrels. And there you see an 18th century printing shop with a barrel in the foreground, but also other kinds of parcel. And I'm afraid that modernization hits in everything. So the only parcel I've yet found in the American documents I've worked on was an ordinary box, not a barrel at all. To make up for the lack of barrels, however, there will be lots of books and readers, and I hope that that will console you. So in the last few years, probably the last 20 years or so, historians of books and reading have turned their attention to colonial America in really wonderful and productive ways, and they've begun to teach us about the multiple and extraordinary roles of writing and reading and books in the colonial world. Now, to begin with, the world they've exposed to us is much more fragile than the one that we probably learned about in school when we were reading Johnny Tremaine or learning about the colonial life. Catherine Grandjean, for example, is a pioneering young scholar, has just published her first book, American Passage, on what it took to send a letter in the 17th century. And what it basically took for about half the year was a Native American, because the whites actually couldn't get anywhere in the snow and in the weather conditions. They didn't know how to do it. So they depended on generous Native Americans to move their messages. It also depended on finding paper, which was rare. So here you see a letter from William Bradford to John Winthrop, the founder of the Plymouth Bay Colony, and I'll come back to him a number of times in the lecture, and you see how tightly written it is and how Winthrop has written his draft of the reply on the same letter because paper is really in short supply. So this is a world, this is not a luxurious world which reads in rooms like this. It's a rather fragile world, and it's one in which books themselves have to be either created on site, and that's one of the great books of the colonies, John Winthrop's Diary of Plymouth Plantation, in his draft in the Massachusetts Historical Society. And indeed, many books in the colonial world are actually published still by being copied by scribes or by the author. Here's another of John Winthrop's works now in the Library of Congress, and this is copies like this were made because it could be just as cheap and efficient to make scribal copies as to send a book to London until late in the 17th century. There's no press at all in the colonies, have it printed and get it back. So publication, circulation often remain matters of writing in this period. When you did want to print a big book, this is Cotton Mather's, well, my iPhone persists in calling this his Magnolia Christi Americana, but it's his Magnalia Christi Americana, which is a great sort of church history of the colonies with fascinating and strange material about witchcraft. He had to print it in England with absolutely disastrous results. Historians have been compiling errata lists ever since it appeared in 1702, and there still isn't a critical edition of the whole thing. Yet at the same time, it was a world which had some surprisingly learned inhabitants. John Winthrop Jr., who will also reappear in my lecture, is here making the happy journey from Boston to Saybrook in 1645 and keeping a diary in Latin, which he wrote as handily as he did English. This is a world in which every year the governor of Massachusetts, the English viceroy, would go to Harvard where a boy would give a speech in Latin and the viceroy would reply extemporaneously in Latin. Not part of the job description of English viceroys nowadays, if there were any. So it's a fascinating world. It's illuminated, as past worlds are, in lightning bursts by particular sources. And I want to take you today into the part of it where we can learn something about how some of the most learned inhabitants of the colonies read their books. The first reader I'll introduce you to is James Logan of Philadelphia. Some of you will probably have made the acquaintance of James Logan. He's an extraordinary figure. He came to Philadelphia as the secretary to William Penn and a Quaker, became a trader, indeed ended up dominating the fur trade in the mid-Atlantic states, and running very hard bargains with the Indians who provided the furs. He was rather the Montgomery Burns of the fur trade and rather far from his Quaker origins by the time his career had really peaked. Became one of the richest men in the colonies. He was also a scientific virtuoso, a correspondent, though not a member of the Royal Society, in touch with very learned circles in Europe, and a reader of learned books in Greek, like this edition of the Tragedies of Aeschylus, and of Latin. In his wonderful Vitruvian country house, Stenton, which still exists, it's a national historical site in Philadelphia, he built up the largest library in the northern colonies in the middle of the 18th century. He had about 2,500 books by the time he died, more than Harvard did at the same time. And his books became the core of the library which pipped the Society Library at the Post, the Library Company of Philadelphia, and the oldest public library in America, because the Society Library couldn't get it together when its first gift was made earlier in the 18th century. Now, Logan was a great reader. He read in many different moods. He read for many different kinds of information and rewards. Sometimes a reading could be quite simple, just a sort of recollection of happy times past with the author in which he pauses only briefly to puncture a little social pretension. This is his copy of Charles Hayes's Treatise on Fluxions, Calculus. And here he writes in 1750, "The author was a fellow student with Charles Arbuthnot, who came over to Pennsylvania about the year 1703 and died in 1719 in the University of Aberdeen. His true name was Charles Hay, but when he came to England, he enlarged himself by calling himself Charles Hayes. He was so studious of the mathematics that he was called by the other scholars generally Euclid. Logan went on to recall meeting Hayes, or Hay, in 1710 at the shop of the bookseller Daniel Midwinter and inviting him to take a glass of wine and talk about their mutual friend Arbuthnot. He called this work of higher mathematics an admirable piece." So this is a lovely crafted note, like a set of Russian dolls, a story about telling stories over a glass of wine in the bookshop of Daniel Midwinter, which we happen to know was on London Bridge, so we can actually locate it. And this gives you a sense of what this kind of learned reading meant for someone who is, as Logan was by then, an old man in what was still not all that literate a city of Philadelphia. Reading took him back to happy times on his trips back to London when he'd been able to mingle with the learned in the places where people like Dr. Johnson and James Boswell and Samuel Richardson also went, these bookshops which entertained their customers with a glass of wine and learned conversation. But Logan's penholder contained many implements, and some of them had sharp and bent nibs. He was known for his temper, and he used it not just on his employees, but also to stab authors he didn't like. For example, Logan owned a sumptuous copy of the late Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus, edited by a productive and influential scholar, Jacob Gronovius, whose magnificently bewigged portrait adorns the book. By the beginning of the editor's preface, Logan writes, "This is in the completely tasteless style that is characteristic of him. Few other notes appear, But one of them is even sharper in its way, not just a slap at someone who writes bad Latin, but a mordant judgment on a bad scholar. On a little slip of paper that he left in the volume, Logan wrote, "Constantinus is, of course, a saint. Julianus is a villain." With this sarcastic remark, he makes clear that Gronovius, in the most conventional possible way, lionized Constantine, the first Christian emperor of Rome, and, of course, debased Julian, who had went back to paganism, and indicates that his own view, like those of Edward Gibbon, who felt more or less the same way, were quite independent of these conventions. Now, it's not surprising that Logan felt able to pass verdicts like this. He didn't just read the texts. He wrote the books that showed you how to read the texts. In this case, for example, he had read the standard book on how to read history in 17th and early 18th century England, a book by the first Oxford professor of ancient history, Degory Weir. Now, Degory Weir's book, and I'm one of two people in this room who's read it, I can say is staggeringly dull. Not as staggeringly dull as Degory Weir, who in his lectures would stop and say, "Won't you listen to me for half an hour at least before going on?" But Logan not only found it interesting, he read it cover to cover with pen in hand, annotating as he went. And that's a different kind of skill in annotation, the scholar's skill of dutiful, hard-buttocked attentiveness, which enabled him to master subjects as radically different as Latin historiography and the calculus. So this is a careful, prosaic reading, but there are much more exciting ones as well. Here, for example, is Logan's copy of The Astronomical Tables of Edmund Halley. Now, this is a book with a really odd history because Halley had it set in type, printed, in 1719, but it wasn't published until 1749, which gave rise to all kinds of speculation about what Halley was doing with this book. Logan, however, saw the proofs, as he recorded, at the bookshop of William Innes, this time 24 Paternoster Row near Amen Corner. And this is a little 18th century view, but it gives you a sense of where he did his shopping. And he managed to persuade the bookseller to sell him a copy of these proofs illicitly. Now, Logan was always a good one for having his cake and eating it too, so he was very pleased to get the book, but very annoyed that Innes, as he said, took a guinea off me for it, and he refused to buy anything else from him for a year or two in penalty. Now, the interest of this book is that Logan read it with a kind of passion that we haven't seen yet. This is his manuscript annotations at the end of the book. And you'll notice that Logan is a good reader in a particular technical sense that anyone else who studies the history of reading will recognize. As my own teacher, Arnaldo Momigliano, once said, a great man with good handwriting is twice a great man. And this is a great man with good handwriting. So he's a wonderful reader. He was following the new science of his time very closely. And here he is following and correcting Halley's astronomical tables. But the real point of this note is a little bit different. And here he actually records making the note as if the note is itself historically important. "I wrote this, my hand weak and trembling from paralysis, on April 23rd, 1745. He's a septuagenarian. He's looking back. And what a scene this was to look back on. No wonder he wrote it up in 8 pages of Latin. On the 22nd of May, 1724, Logan took a day trip from London to Windsor with Springer, John, and Thomas Penn, all members of the William Penn family, as well as some of their relatives, and what he described as an enormous crowd of others, both nobles and ordinary people. It was a dramatic occasion, a kind of scientific counterpart to the hangings at Tyburn that brought such great crowds out in the same period. A solar eclipse was coming. Two rival astronomers, Halley and William Whiston, had drawn up predictions about where it would reach totality. Halley had actually published a shadow map, a brilliant way of displaying technical information in an immediately comprehensible form, showing where he thought the zone of totality would be. Whiston predicted that the eclipse would not be total anywhere within easy reach of London. Halley, by contrast, included Windsor in the zone of totality, so everyone who was anyone went to Windsor. "Expecting to see the sun wholly obscured," Logan reports, "we returned in a state of frustration, for the heavens favored Halley since they were covered with clouds. Still, we considered it certain that the moon did not block off all the sun's light, as Halley had predicted. And a few days later, attending a meeting of the Royal Society, Logan heard Newton himself ask Halley to discuss the eclipse, and thought Halley seemed quite happy that he could, as Logan said, conceal his error by invoking the cloud cover. Now, Logan was sure that Whiston was the better astronomer and totality hadn't been reached while he was present, even though we have no idea why he thought this, since the cloud cover made it impossible to tell. He also wondered if Halley had delayed publishing his tables because he knew they were faulty from this and other cases. So in cases like this, annotation doesn't look like reading in any sense which is really conventional now, a private effort to decipher and come to terms with the meaning of a text. It's much more like a performance, a calculated effort to transform a book by someone else into a document that reflects the reader's life and times. Now, Logan read books of a great many kinds, though not all the books you might expect him to. He was a political philosopher, for example, and we don't have any annotated books of political philosophy in his hand. He was a lawyer, and we have no law books with annotations by him. That's quite curious. But he read science, he read political economy, he read classical scholarship, he read natural history, and he annotated all of it with these wonderful and legible annotations. And these were cataloged by a great scholar. Before there was book history, in the 1950s and 60s, there was a great librarian, Edwin Wolfe II of Philadelphia, a wonderful man, never went to college. He was from a rich Philadelphia family, and they sent him to an English boarding school where he learned Latin and Greek. But he escaped college and going to law school, which they had destined him for, both in the war and after the war. He went to work for Rosenbach, the bookseller, and spent many years working for Rosenbach, and then moved to the then almost derelict Library Company of Philadelphia. And he had an epiphany one day when he pulled a book from the shelves, realized it was annotated, and realized how rich a historical source the annotations were. So he dedicated himself to the study of Logan's library, and in 1974 he published a magnificent catalog of Logan's books, which is comprehensive, brilliantly done, extremely accurate. His Latin and Greek were very good, and he could read these annotations with considerable, if not quite perfect, accuracy. So why on earth, you might ask, would somebody like me want to climb Mount Logan again, much less look from the top of Mount Logan at the other mountains of annotation that the colonies produced? And here I think there's a double answer. One is that when you start working with Logan, you just get completely hooked. He's such a strange and fascinating person. But the other is that there's a story here that Wolfe couldn't tell. The history of reading came after Wolfe. He wasn't in a position to contextualize what Logan did, to connect it to the way in which other people wrote in books, to tell you what this historical style of annotation might be and mean. And that's something we are in a position to do now. So using Wolfe's work with incredible gratitude, I'm trying to move out from it and look at other Logan and other colonial reader, pen-in-hand readers, and see what I can learn. Now, the general form of annotation that Logan was practicing is immediately recognizable to the few of us frenzied pedants who know it. It's the way of a late humanist polymath, one of those erudite dinosaurs who romped through the pedantic park that was the Republic of Letters in the 16th and 17th centuries and took every imaginable form, the gigantic brontosauruses like Athanasius Kircher, the great German Jesuit savant who read Arabic and Hebrew as easily as Latin and Greek, translated Egyptian hieroglyphs wrongly, but he still translated them, played football with his fellow Jesuits against the Dominicans, spelunked in the mountain, in the cavern of Mount Vesuvius while it was beginning to erupt, and generally had a great adventurous scholarly life. But there were also really nasty people in this world, little raptors who bit and tore, and there were tyrannosauruses. It's an extraordinary kind of paleontology that the scholars of this world practice. Now, the kind of person that, and Logan was a great admirer of these people, the kind of person that he really admired was Isaac Casaubon, great Protestant scholar of the late 16th and early 17th century, a man who spent his life reading hours and hours every day, pen in hand, marking locking up his books. Logan describes him here in a note with uncharacteristic awe. Isaac Casaubon was by far the most outstanding of all the philologists or critics who have flourished in the last two centuries, both on account of his learning and on account of his wonderful judgment, which is the most important thing. After all, he points out, no one ever criticized Casaubon until the very end of his life when he engaged in ecclesiastical polemic against Cardinal Baronio. And that, as he pointed out, is quite rare in the history of scholarship. One thing scholars do is criticize one another, so there must have been something special about Casaubon. And the main thing that was special about Casaubon was his passion for reading, even in a reading world. This is Casaubon's bladder. Casaubon sat in his study every day. He combed his hair before he went upstairs. Then he sat himself down in his study, prayed in Hebrew or Greek or Latin or French, and started reading. And that was all he wanted to do. When friends came, he would shriek, "Amici inimici, my friends are my enemies." He hated being interrupted. He also refused ever to go to the bathroom. And so when he died and a young surgeon autopsied him, it was discovered that he had done this to his bladder. Now, in the 17th century, this was actually a sign of heroism. Protestants couldn't have saints, but they could have scholars who sacrificed themselves to the calling of reading. And so when Casaubon's collected letters were published, the frontispiece was adorned by the portrait of his face, but the body of the text was adorned by the portrait of his bladder. This is as close as a Protestant could come to being one of those Baroque Catholic saints who would be autopsied and whose hearts would have been consumed to ash by their devotion to God. So this is serious reading. Reading carried out with equipment of a sort we no longer use, in conditions of strenuous attentiveness that we find it hard to imagine as we read on screen, our attention diverted by links every 32 seconds. This is a man who could read 60 pages of heavily abbreviated printed Greek in a six-hour session, pen in hand while annotating it, which is just about inconceivable now. He's an extraordinary scholar. And to give you a sense of how he read, this is a printed copy of the Greek historian Polybius, which Casaubon annotated so heavily that the Bodleian Library calls it a manuscript. It's a printed book which has undergone metamorphosis back into its original larval state. So this is the kind of reader that was Logan's model. But which kind? How do we get closer? These men read in all sorts of ways. So when I came to the Society Library and fell into Aaron's wonderful pit of annotated books that nobody had looked at, it became clear that one of the richest bodies of material we have for thinking about reading in the colonies is that created by the Winthrop family, one of the great families of early America, and the largest portion of whose library to be in one piece is right here in this library, though there are other parts of it in the New York Academy of Medicine, not very far away, in the Massachusetts Historical Society, at Harvard, at Yale, in Allegheny College, and elsewhere. And I and my colleague at Princeton, Jenny Rampling, hope eventually to do a complete survey of this material. They're a fascinating group of people, starting with Adam Winthrop, a Cambridge-educated country lawyer and squire, John Winthrop, the man who took ship for Plymouth and founded the Plymouth colony and was its ruler, John Winthrop Jr., the most fascinating of all the Winthrops. He studied at Trinity College, Dublin. He was an alchemist. He was an entrepreneur. He was a bit of a flim-flam man who started many economic enterprises, built them up, got blast furnaces going and factories moving, and then left when they stopped making any money, and so always managed to get a better job. He ends up as governor of Connecticut and is actually the governor of Connecticut who gives the crunch to the previously independent colony of New Haven and makes Connecticut what it is today. But he's also a fascinating person, a religious sectary, an antinomian, very sympathetic to other religious strivers. His father had already liked Roger Williams, but John is a real searcher. Then there's Samuel Winthrop, another son of John, a Latin-reading sugar planter in Barbados. And then the next generation, the wonderfully named Wait Still Winthrop. There is some controversy about what he was waiting for, whether these were family names or something else. When you begin to put together the materials that the Winthrops created and collected, you begin to see, I think, very clearly where Logan is coming from. So like Logan, the Winthrops were polymaths. They took a special interest, especially John Jr. and Waite Still, in alchemy, but they also read classical texts, modern sermons, works of history, works of theology, accounts of witch trials with equal zeal. They marked their books in the neat fashion of habitual annotators, and they read some of the same extraordinarily obscure things. I was gobsmacked to find that Adam Winthrop had read and translated some of the work of Olympia Fulvia Morata, a 16th century Italian reformer, never terribly widely known, one of the most important of the women reformers of the 16th century, and even more so to find that the Winthrops owned a copy of her book as well. That Logan owned a copy of her book as well. It's really quite not the sort of thing that you'd expect to find as a common interest. They read often, both of them, Logan and the Winthrops, for very practical reasons. Here, Logan is reading Henry Cornelius Agricola's great book on mining because he's got a mining investment. It's not going very well, so naturally he goes to a 1540 Latin book to see how he can improve it. And here you see John Winthrop Jr. using one of his many alchemical works to record a ciphered recipe, which crowdsourcing deciphered very rapidly. The point is that many of these books are really business books, and you can't ever tell which ones are for business and which ones are for pleasure a priori. You have to see what they actually do to them. Their ways of reading are strikingly similar. Logan took a special interest in the previous owners of his books, and he liked to recall how he had obtained them. For example, he used his copy of an astronomical treatise by a French savant, Ismael Bouillot, to record how he'd obtained not just that book, but the first lot of big lot of books that he'd bought in the New World on the Wissahickon stream. And here he says in Latin, of course, "This book belonged to Johann Jakob Zimmermann, the famous German astronomer, who died in Holland around 1691 while preparing, or rather setting out on his journey to Pennsylvania. But his family, together with his companions, one of whom became so dear to me that I served as his pallbearer, continued on their way to this province and settled in Germantown. There in the year 1708, I bought it with a few other books, J. Logan." And again, Logan does this documentation of where, how, when he obtains books. The Winthrops also filled their books with this kind of bibliophilic autobiography. So here's John Winthrop writing in a copy of a bibliography of Florentine writers to recall a close encounter with a book by the Florentine Neoplatonist Marsilio Ficino. "I saw this volume, in which I read through some things from the book on the sun and on light, in the library of the college at Edinburgh while I was in Scotland in the year 1634. Logan owned a good many books that had belonged to quite distinguished previous owners. So this is his copy of the Roman astrological poem of Manilius. And you'll notice that on the top is the two words, "Tanquam explorator," as a spy. That's Ben Jonson's motto. So this is Ben Jonson's copy. Here is a copy of the Greek writing of Xenophon that belonged to Philemon Holland, who was a very distinguished English translator in the great Elizabethan age of translation. This is one of the rare points where I think Wolfe actually went wrong. Wolfe basically thought that Logan bought books like a vacuum cleaner and simply hoovered up some of these association copies. In fact, I think that association copies mattered greatly to these people, that this was one of the ways in which buying a book and getting it to the Americas could build a kind of mental and emotional connection to a wider world of scholarship and thought. And I'll give you my favorite example. This is a copy of the ancient astronomer Ptolemy that belonged to John Logan, in a 1538 edition of his work in Greek. It was given to him by a friend in Hamburg, the great classical bibliographer Johann Fabricius, in 1722. Fabricius sent him 8 books, very rare ones from his own library, and Logan was so grateful that he repaid him with an Indian-dressed buffalo skin, certainly worth more than any given 8 books, a really tremendous gift. And what he liked about this book, we know from his correspondence, was not its physical form. He actually says the paper is very mean and it must not have cost very much. What he loved about it was that it was a book that bore layers of notes in it, and that those layers of notes put it in a particular world. So here is on top the presentation inscription from Fabricius to Logan, written out in beautiful copper plate, Johann Albert Fabricius, doctor of theology and professor in the gymnasium at Hamburg, sent this book from his library from Hamburg to Philadelphia as a gift to James Logan. One of the very rare mistakes that Wolff made was to think that that was part of the same note. It actually isn't. It's Logan going on in Latin to record his receipt of the book and to say what's especially good about this is that it contains the annotations of Johann Friedrich Granovius. And then he lays out information for future readers about how to know whose notes are which are Granovius, which are Fabricius, which are Logan. So the book becomes a record of generations of scholarly effort. And that, I think, gives one a sense of just how fascinated he is. He even tries to tell you whose underlining is whose. Now, there was every reason to be interested in books that actually had interesting provenances. For one thing, they were worth more than books that weren't. Here is one of John Winthrop's books. It's actually in the display case outside, so you can see it in reality afterwards. And under those notes in a beautiful 16th century handwriting, Winthrop writes, "The above is written in the name on the top of the frontispiece in the book, and the writing in the middle of the frontispiece, and the several notes in the margins through the whole book were all written by that famous philosopher and chemist, John Dee." This is Queen Elizabeth's astrologer, the man who set the date for Elizabeth's coronation by astrological reckoning. "I have divers books that were his, wherein he hath written his name, and many notes, for which they are worthily the more esteemed, John Winthrop, 1640. So association copies were simply more valuable. They were more precious. They had various kinds of value in this world. So here is a book of Logan's in which he simply records that it was sold to him by a friend who had it from the son of the friend who owned it and annotated it. So it's a book that he has as a kind of memento of this dead friend. Here we have a book that belonged to Adam Winthrop, which is now in the Princeton University Library. It's our one Winthrop book. And it's a quite wonderful, I love it. It's a real wonderful association copy. It belonged to Adam, the founder of the dynasty. He apparently wrote in it, "This shall be given to Vincent." We don't know who Vincent was, but Adam gave Vincent a lot of his books. So Vincent was a collector of association books. And then Thomas Shepard, who had the book still later, didn't eliminate any of this material, so he was clearly interested. And somebody else writes this wonderful thing, "Lege, lege, aliquid hirebit, read, read, something will stick." Which, you know, could be the motto of all teachers, I guess. And in the back paste down, you can actually see sort of dueling owners writing little verses in the book. So the top one says, the drop carves out the stone, not by force, but just because lots of drops fall. So a man becomes wise, not by force, but by reading a lot. And then somebody else writes, "The voice you hear to perishes, but the written letter remains." So sort of one axiom after another, they're personalizing the book, and each later owner finds it the more valuable as there are the more layers of personalization. I think my particular favorite in the Society Library's Winthrop books is this, a book of Basil Valentine that belonged to the famous philosopher and naturalist Cornel Drebbel, who usually carried it with him in his pocket, and after his death was given to me by his son-in-law. This gives you a sense. Cornelius Drebbel, to those who haven't met him, was a Dutch engineer who built perpetual motion machines, organs that played pneumatically, and a submarine in which he took people from Tower Bridge to Greenwich and back underwater. He had some means for replacing oxygen. We don't actually know what. He's quite an impressive fellow. So, yeah, you'd want to have an association book of his. Another favorite, this one from the New York Academy of Medicine, is a book that belonged to Edward Howes, and there you see Book of Edward Howes and His Friends. Edward Howes was a mathematician and antinomian in London who sent John Winthrop Jr. many of his books, and when John made it to London, they went and explored occult circles together. And he modestly says, "This book is the fountain of eternal philosophy and wisdom." Just what you'd want to know. So here you have a page that's been tipped in with a note signed by the author of the book. And it's actually not from this copy, it's from some other copy. And here a note from John Winthrop saying that he had found a book by the author on sale in The Hague and cut out that page and kept it and put it in his own copy. Now, all of this together, I think, gives you a rich sense of the way in which books were historic objects layered and sedimented with experience and meaning. And the way in which when you were sitting in Connecticut and your blast furnace didn't work, at least you could take a book down and think, oh, it was such fun in The Hague cutting that page out of that book. Now, Logan and Winthrop have some very particular common practices, and I'll just mention one kind, which is particularly unfamiliar now. They were obsessive biobibliographers. They had only to open a book to start thinking about who is the actual author and what they could put down that they or some future reader might want to know. So this is G.J. Vossius, a very learned Dutch scholar's book on ancient mathematicians and artists, and Logan has squeezed some information from the book about when Vossius wrote it and who his teachers were. This is Vitruvius, the one Roman treatise on architecture that survives. This is a book that was a very serious practical meaning to Logan because it's Vitruvian principles that he used to build Stenton. He designed the house himself. But his notes here are all about the identity, not even of the author, but of the 16th century French commentator who wrote the commentary on the book. Here, this is a copy of a great Renaissance satire, The Letters of Obscure Men. Johannes Reuchlin was a pioneering Hebraist, and when various people attacked him for bringing Jewish material into the study of the Bible, he got famous people like Erasmus to write testimonials for him, which he published under the title Letters of Famous Men. And two very smarky young men published a set of parodies of his opponents under the title Letters of Obscure Men. A book so funny that Erasmus supposedly got apoplexy reading it. At all events, here's a long note on the authorship of this, which was still disputed. Here you see him worrying about whether Aeschylus, the Greek tragedian, actually spent time in Sicily, as his language suggested. So over and over again, it's as if Logan feels that a key to a book is all the information you can compile about its author and the circumstances of composition. And here, too, the Winthrops are very similar. Adam Winthrop loved to put these biobibliographical introductions, especially in books about the church and religion. And you know, it's clearly a practice. Now, one of the things we would like to understand better, and that I and my friends working on this would like to know better, is how you learned to do this kind of reading and annotating. Was it something your tutor taught you when you were at school or at Cambridge? Was it something you saw people doing? And it could be very sophisticated. Here is a book that's also in the Society Library. Sir Thomas Smith was Elizabeth's ambassador to France. He wrote a book on the English state. And he wrote a letter to a friend, not included in the book, in which he tells you how to read it. And here he says that what he's done is to write the Commonwealth of England as the ancient philosopher Aristotle would have done. Aristotle compiled 168 accounts of the constitutions of ancient states. His students did, actually, his research assistants. And only one of these survives, and that hadn't been discovered in the Renaissance. So Smith basically imagines what one of these texts would have been and uses that as the format for writing about England. And remarkably, Adam Winthrop finds that and copies it out in this beautiful copperplate in the beginning of the book. So here there's a practice of annotation which is hermeneutically sophisticated, which says that you don't just give biobibliography, but you look for what you can say about the goal, the point of the book, what's special about it. Now, where did Adam learn to do this? Well, one person that we've thought about is John Dee. This is Adam's handwriting, that's John Dee's handwriting. It's kind of separated at birth. And sometimes when you see Adam, you really think you're looking at Dee. here's a book that belonged to Dee, which is now unfortunately in private hands. There he is doing biobibliography in the in the flyleaf, just as Adam Winthrop does. Here are a couple of notes in which Dee, just like the Winthrops, dates the points at which he saw particular books and records those as a kind of marginal literary autobiography. So it's possible that Adam as a Cambridge man and Dee as a Cambridge man reflect some kind of common training. It's also possible, though, that Adam simply learned by reading. This is a copy of a book by Philip Melanchthon, a great German scholar and theologian, on the soul, which Adam bought with a kind of introductory remark like the one he entered in Thomas Smith, already entered on the page on the flyleaf facing the title page. So it's possible he learned from reading the annotated books that he already bought. We simply don't know. But what happens after Adam is clear. Old Winthrops teach young Winthrops how to read. We have found at least one pair of books bound together in which old Adam Winthrop is teaching his grandson, John Jr., how to do bibliography. And the continuity in their practices is most wonderful in one point. We've seen that they really liked John Dee. They thought John Dee was big stuff. They actually knew Arthur Dee. And so this is John Dee's hieroglyphical monad, which is a text based around the symbol, which includes the moon, the sun, Aries, and is a symbol that basically reflects the harmony and unity of all the universe. The Winthrops learned to use the hieroglyphic monad to mark their books. So there you see John Winthrop Jr. doing his little hieroglyphic monad, and there's Wait Still Winthrop, his son, learning how to do his hieroglyphic monad. John is also giving you a little anagram. John Winthrop also spells, I hope, wins a throne. Wait Still doesn't. Oddly enough, you would think Wait Still would have liked an anagram of some sort for his grandma. He doesn't seem to have done that. But what you see here is a kind of family tradition in annotation, which goes on over generations. This is a bit of a surprise in the colonies. It's the kind of thing you'd be much more expecting to find in a Swiss city in the same period, with one of those families that produced three or four generations who held the same professorial chair. Now, what this leaves Logan as a bigger problem, and I simply haven't been able to work out in full detail how Logan learned to be such an engaged reader. Fascinatingly, for someone whose Latin was fluent, whose Greek was excellent, whose Arabic and Hebrew were also very good, who was conversant with so many fields of learning, Logan did not ever attend any advanced school or university. He was a Quaker, so he wouldn't have been able to do so, honestly. He studied with his father, who was a schoolmaster, and otherwise he taught himself. And so I've been going through the datable books in Logan's library, trying to work out how he learns to be a reader. This is the oldest one we have. This is a copy of Johann Buchsdorf's Hebrew and Aramaic Lexicon. And this is a book that Logan actually owned while he was still in Scotland, before he came to America. In 1698, he sold his first library, 700 books, in order to go into cloth making, which was a complete disaster. This is one of the very few books that survives from that. And you can see that he's read very carefully. At every Hebrew word where you get a root, he enters in pencil the biblical verses where that word appears, which is a considerable feat, either of memory or of extremely dogged work. But it's very unlike the kinds of notes that appear in his later books, not just in style, but also in content. So a second thought was that Logan might have learned from friends. He did have a couple of erudite friends in Pennsylvania. One of them was William Penn. Logan, who knew Latin, of course, extremely well. Another was a wonderful gentleman called Francis Daniel Pastorius, a very learned German Quaker who founded Germantown. Was a notary, a lawyer, a teacher, and many other things, and who was a real product of that world of European learning that Logan longed for all his life. Pastorius went to a German gymnasium, a secondary school, where you could only speak Latin because the headmaster was Hungarian and didn't speak any German. So Latin was the only language he had in common with his students. And Pastorius annotated his books, some of which survive in the Library Company of Philadelphia, very fully. But the annotation just doesn't look like Logan. It's kind of baroque in its form, in the way that it plays with and wreaths the spaces in the text. It's also sometimes witty, as here, where he, in reading a chapter about codes and ciphers, he gives you the language of flowers and leaves. And sometimes it's actually comic, as here, where he makes a little humanist pun. This is a description of a work on political philosophy, which tells you that in the imperial court in Speyer is a very important center of litigation. And he says, yes, many cases breathe here. They spirant, but they never expire. They never actually get settled. That's not much of a joke. Humanists weren't that funny, but it's not. I have yet to find anything like that in Logan's books. It's just this kind of playing with the text. Here, this is a little bit more like Logan, where Pastorius, encountering a nasty discussion of Quakers, cuts it out and says, all of this is false. Now, that's a little more like Logan, but I don't think you needed to read another person's annotations actually to work that out. So my second theory, which is much more like what I suggested at the end about Adam Winthrop, is that Logan really, as he went to those European shops and bought annotated books, as he met these parties of settlers who had interesting books, read them not just for their printed content, but for their notes, and learned from the notes to make the kind of notes he wanted to. This is that copy of Bouillot that he bought on the Wissahickon, from the copy that had belonged to the astronomer Zimmermann. Zimmermann had used the first few blank pages as the space in which to make very detailed technical recomputations of some of the astronomical parameters in the book. Well, Logan did exactly the same with his copy of the first edition of Newton's Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. And if you just look, there's something so similar about the way in which these things are laid out on the first blanks. It's hard for me not to think that he found a kind of license in Zimmermann to do this kind of writing of himself technically into Newton's book. Now, this is an extraordinarily interesting book. This is the first copy of Newton to reach the American colonies. And it seems almost certain to me that Logan actually got this from Zimmermann's bequest as he got the Bouillot, because he bought it, he tells us, in 1708. He doesn't tell us anything else about it, but that's when he was buying astronomical books. And if we look closely at this, we get a little further hint of learning to read. Here at this book is annotated by Zimmermann to tell you how to read Newton while not making more effort than you have to. And, you know, to read Newton is a big effort anyhow. So here, Zimmermann tells us, after you've got this far reading Newton's System of the World to here, you can skip down and read the planetary system. You'll be able to understand the planetary system. You don't need the rest. And if you look down there, you'll see that that Logan has verified this. And you know, so I think that Logan is following Zimmermann through the book, learning that marking a book like Hansel and Gretel with little stones or crumbs is one of the ways in which you can annotate a really complicated and difficult book. One of the most beautiful books that Logan owned is this 1594 Arabic Euclid from the Medici Press in Rome, which he annotated in his own beautiful Arabic handwriting. But he didn't just annotate it, he used it and he actually made a translation of the preface from Arabic into Latin, which he drafts parts of in the margins of the book itself, the hard phrases he's working out. Now, his copy of Philemon Holland's Xenophon, which Philemon Holland used to publish his own translation, had the same kind of use of the margin to work out the hard passages in a running translation. So once again, I think we find him not just owning this book, but actually using it, reading it, taking it as a model. So one of the things I'm hoping to do, if I can reassemble enough of these stories, is to tell the story of Logan as a reader and tell the stories of the Winthrops as readers, and really work out in depth and detail how each of them does their learning to read, and what the differences as well as similarities are between Logan the autodidact and the Winthrops, who belong to an intergenerational community of readers, which includes women of some. We don't yet have a book annotated by a Winthrop woman, but there's a wonderful letter from Anna Winthrop to Adam in which she's going on in the usual Elizabethan lady way, oh, I miss you so much, my lord, it's so terrible that you're not here. And suddenly she moves into French to thank him for having her French Bible bound. And it's just really nice. So we're really very eager to see if we can get any more evidence about that side of the story. What we are learning, what we have learned, and I think this isn't really as yet part of the common sense about books and readers in colonial America, is how much really erudite reading was going on from a very early time, how varied and how fascinating the kinds of books are. One of the things I haven't mentioned at all is illustration, but out in the show there's a wonderful little drawing of London Bridge by John Winthrop Jr., which I recommend to you. These are my favorite drawings from a book that was in the colonies. This is from one of the books that was in the Sharp collection, the original collection destined to be the core of this library, and 149 books from which are actually here. This particular one got away and is at the General Theological Seminary downtown. As you see, it has these quite wonderful doodles by a student who was both bored and talented early in the 16th century. And here shows you a German Landsknecht or soldier consulting a learned man, a doctor or a lawyer. And here has these quite wonderful devils with faces around their bottoms who are doing I'm not sure quite what. So if we ever could get a really full sense of the sort of stock of books that was available to a Winthrop, a Logan, a Mather, and that's what I'm hoping to do, I think we'll have a sense of this strange, primitive, fragile colonial world as also being a province of a very cosmopolitan, European, Latin-reading, Newton-deciphering world. And that's a story about the colonial Americas that hasn't really been told. I'll just close with one more real curiosity. This is, many of the long notes that Logan inserts in his books come from his last decade when he was ill, basically paralyzed and pretty much confined to the ground floor of Stenton where his books were. And a number of them are clearly designed not just to shed light on the books, but to tell the kind of story that he told about the Halleys, stories about his own career. Now, Logan, like Adam Winthrop, really liked church history. He read a lot of church history. This is a really remarkable work. It's by a liberal Dutch minister, Philip van Limborch, friend of Leclerc and Locke, correspondent of John Locke. And it's a history of the Inquisition, which, of course, he doesn't like very much. And it rests on a whole book of sentences of the Inquisition from the city of Toulouse, which he actually reproduced from a manuscript. And he not only reproduces the manuscript, he reproduces the seals to show you that he's reproducing a genuine document. So it's a very important polemical work in the great late 17th century polemics, which were kicked off by the revocation of the Edict of Nantes and the expulsion of Protestants from France. Now, in his copy, Logan inserts a long note in which he tells two sort of shaggy dog stories of a bibliographical kind. He notes that the manuscript that Limborch used, that manuscript with the seals, was provided by an English Quaker, another friend of Locke named Benjamin Furley. He himself had known Benjamin Furley, Furley's brother John, he tells us, and John inherited the manuscript and actually let Logan use it for some time. But he also goes on to tell another story. A Jesuit asked Benjamin if he could see this manuscript and promised that if it were genuine, he would testify that it was. But though he saw the manuscript in February and noted that down, when he wrote about it, he said he'd seen it in March. And apparently this was designed somehow to shed so doubt about the veracity of the manuscript. I said it was a shaggy dog story. This was a truly Jesuitical deception, comments Logan after he describes how Benjamin detects it and goes to a magistrate and exposes it. Now, this is a strange kind of a story. And it's a story that clearly matters to Logan because, unlike most marginalia, it's done in two versions. He wrote a draft Then he corrected the draft. Then he copied the corrected draft into the book, but he left the corrected original draft, which is somewhat different from the final one, in the book. And at this point, one begins to wonder what he's actually doing. Is he really annotating at all? Or is he, in the mid-18th century era of biographical obsession, which also produced Boswell's Life of Johnson, many other works of a new kind of intimate detail about individuals and their lives, turning the marginal note into a kind of autobiography of a scale and detail that had never been seen before, writing his autobiography in Latin marginal notes? Is this even possible? Well, I don't have any other explanation for this and other notes like it. At all events, it seems to me that we have in this story a different early America, an early America which hasn't been brought to light before. And it's an early America inhabited by some of the most important, wealthy, powerful, influential, original people in early America. Logan and the Winthrops are dominant figures in their society. So to see them with their books is to see them doing something that evidently matters to them, that's perhaps sometimes a pastime, but not always a pastime. It's to get a look at an America which really doesn't look like the many other early Americas historians have given us. And I think it perhaps explains why Logan could hope that Edwin Wolfe II would materialize 200 years later to catalog his marginal notes and bring other people to them, and that I hope will justify a considerable further investment in hunting down, collecting, transcribing. The Winthrops did not have as good handwriting after Adam as James Logan, and understanding this extraordinary record. Thank you so much. They're very interested. Logan's really interested in prices. The Winthrops, not so much. We did find one book which recorded that the first owner had paid X and had paid 15 shillings and the second owner only 12. Apparently, in that case, the first owner's notes were considered to be something that took value away. Logan kept an enormous correspondence with his book dealers in London, which is happily in the Pennsylvania Historical Society, which happens to be next door to the Library Company of Philadelphia, so you can run back and forth. And he was a very hard bargainer. He was a great buyer, but always furious with his booksellers, as many great collectors have been. And it is clear that he wanted real value for his money and that he took great pride in getting the better of a bookseller. So, the financial value is a big part of this. And I'm sure that's what Winthrop meant as well when he talks about his books of D, that, you know, these are esteemed, but they're also just really more valuable.
Thanks.
There's a hand over there. In Logan's case, we see that he is, what interests me about him most is he's passionate about very contemporary things. So he's following the great debate that Newton started about the chronology of the ancient world. There's a recent excellent book on this by Jed Buchwald and Marty Feingold. Huge book because it's a huge debate that involves scholars all over Europe. Newton basically decides that all of ancient history is wrong and he can redo it with astronomical evidence. And Logan is following this. I mean, he must have been going down to the wharf and getting the newest periodicals as they came off the ships. So that is what you might expect from a savant in the 1720s and 1730s. but he's also reading really erudite stuff about church history of the sort that, say, Gibbon read in order to write The Decline and Fall, but that most English laymen wouldn't have been reading, and particularly a Quaker who really doesn't come out of the world of Anglican learning. So in Logan's case, what's fascinating is just that he's a sort of polymath in a way that seems less likely in the 18th than in the 17th century. The Winthrops are fascinating because they turn out to be really wild when you know them in their books and in their annotations. I mean, John Winthrop Jr. is the governor of Connecticut. He's an antinomian. His dad did really bad things to antinomians during the antinomian controversy. So it's really quite striking that he and his buddy go off and listen to the mystical sermons of John Everard. There's this great book by David Como on these circles, which has really good things to say about John Winthrop. So, but you wouldn't know this if you didn't actually follow him into the margins and see quite how wild he is. On the other hand, his alchemy, and here my colleague Jenny Rampling can read these things much better than any of the rest of us, his alchemy is real alchemy. I mean, we've learned in the last generation that alchemy is actually practical chemistry. It wasn't a fake. I mean, almost everything that they talk about allegorically is a real chemical reaction, mostly with metallic crystals. And so he's doing real chemistry that has to do with metals, and he's running blast furnaces and assaying and selling ore. So there's a way in which he also shows you how alchemy is a very practical, still 18th century discipline. So yeah, you do really learn a lot about not just about the people, which I focused on tonight, but about the map of the arts and sciences in the 18th century world. Sir. I think they expected to be read. I think that they saw these as historical deposits. James Logan saw himself as a major historical figure who's leaving a library, and he actually left, the library was left in central Philadelphia as the Bibliotheca Loganiana before it moved into the library company. I think he expected that he would be read and that these notes would be found and people would say, wow, you know, look at this amazing life that this man we knew as a merchant and a trader was actually leading. The Winthrops, it's harder to say because it seems to me they're more writing for each other. Their handwriting is not designed to be deciphered by anybody else after Adam. It's as if they're all disobeying the grandfather who had good handwriting. They're more businesslike, but even there, it's clear that by the 19th century, when the family breaks up the library and puts it in these permanent repositories, the family had a sense that these are significant historical documents. Yeah?
In your own book, The Culture of Correction, you show how manuscripts were corrected before they were printed and how other errors came in during that whole process. As you look at the marginalia that is correcting things in these authors, can you see where they are finding their sources that justify what they think are corrections to the errors in the books they're actually marking?
Yeah, Logan is a real marker of errors, and not just errors, every kind of error. And partly, and one of the things that you did if you were a proper reader in the 17th century was you started with the errata list, and you entered all of the errata, you corrected them all before you actually read the book. I mean, that's what a serious person would do. And the longer the errata list, the more carefully you would do this. So Logan does that. But he's also comparing, so he'll compare one edition of an ancient text with another edition and pull what he thinks are better readings. He'll make conjectures that he thinks are better grammar or better syntax. And when it's a question of math, he was an extremely proficient mathematician, so he'll often recompute things and find mistakes in Newton's or Halley's computations. So it's a very powerful process of correction, and odd for such a private one, because most of it is not, it's really, this is just serious reading for him. When you read, you look for the mistakes in order to know what you can trust. Ma'am.
Aaron taught a wonderful course here on reading patterns in colonial
We haven't yet found marginalia in this erudite world, but it's going to be there. Bill Sherman, who's a friend of ours and a wonderful historian of printing, looked at every early book in the Huntington Library, which is many thousands, in one long crazy summer. And he was just looking to see which ones had been annotated. In the 18th and 19th centuries, annotations were not liked by collectors and librarians, and the books were often chemically washed to get rid of them. And he estimated that something like 40% of these books had been seriously annotated. So reading with pen, and many of them vernacular books, recipe books, prayer books, Bibles, many of them owned by women, even if the marginalia were illegible. These are English marginalia, but I'm sure the colonies are no different. You know, to be a good Protestant, you had to be literate. You had to be able to read your Bible. You had to be able to read your prayer book. You had to be able to pray and confess your sins. And that held for women as well as for men as a really absolute and powerful command. So I suspect the literacy rates were, and if you read the things they're arguing about in the 17th century, there are female antinomians as well as male antinomians, and they get interrogated, and their knowledge of theology is really striking and rich and thorough, and they come up with wonderful and strange principles. So I'm just waiting to find my first colonial learned female annotator. I'm sure she's out there somewhere. Yeah. I am thinking that for people like John Winthrop Jr., who really wanted to be in Europe and was not happy sitting in Connecticut, or for James Logan, this really was the way you got a psychic connection to the place you wanted to be. In much the same world that the way that the internet now provides, for when you were Skype, when you're elsewhere, it was a way of erasing distance, moving yourself psychically back where you wanted to be. And I do think that fragility, by the early 18th century, things are solid. And they'll say, a house here, it's just like an English house. It rents for the same an English house would rent for. But in the 17th century, it's really not like that yet. I think that's one of the things that colonial social history is only kind of beginning to emphasize. That makes a great deal of sense. I think one of the things that you have in colonial America is there's nowhere particular to go if you want to natter about the latest erudite publications. You don't really have coffee shops. You don't really, saloons are not where you would do that. Church is not where you would do that. And I think the way you did it was by reading. You did it in a fairly solitary way and maybe communicated by letter with other people who shared those interests. As far as Logan, he really seems to keep his life of book commerce and his life of commerce pretty separate, except when he sends Fabricius the buffalo robe. That's the one case where he seems to let he crosses the streams. Otherwise, it's as if the two things are somehow separate, even though some of the reading is clearly done to pursue particular economic opportunities, or particular ways of exploiting minerals or other things. But I have a lot of correspondence yet to read. The Pennsylvania Historical Society is very rich.
Sort of, broadsheet type. What is that relationship like?
They're interested. I mean, John Winthrop mentions very little about books in his Diary of Plymouth Plantation, but he does mention the printing of the Bay Psalm book. So, you know, clearly it was exciting to him that there was a press and that it was printing something that, you know, would be useful. They really see these guys. Delmore Schwartz, the poet and critic in the 50s, once said, "Europe is still the biggest thing in America," in the 1950s. And I think for these people, Europe was the biggest thing in America in 1700 or 1680. They really don't think the homegrown knowledge is very deep. And actually, one way in which they contrast, interestingly, with another group is the Spanish in New Spain and in the Andes were very convinced that there was tremendous local knowledge, botanical knowledge, mineralogical knowledge, historical knowledge, encoded in the languages of the natives, and their codices they'd mostly destroyed or taken away. But they did think that serious study of the languages would really tell them things. In New England, they study the languages to evangelize, but they don't study them. And this is one thing which I have yet to find in any of these people, is that sense of, you know, we study these languages in order to read our way to the extent we can into this new world. And that really is quite striking, and, you know, does suggest that they're a little bit in a kind of old world bubble intellectually. Yes. That's a big story, but again, it doesn't really hit these people. I think the people who are aware of that are the Mathers, and I haven't yet begun to open the 1,400 books of the Mathers in the Massachusetts Historical Society or the ones at Harvard, Boston Public Law. I suspect that there's a lot of material there. Sor Juana was actually reading Athanasius Kircher and imagining herself as Isis, the Egyptian goddess, as whom he had described in Christian terms. And she's an incredibly sophisticated reader. But she comes out of a different kind of monastic culture for which there are counterparts in England, but I haven't yet found them in America. You know, people like Lady Conway in England who are reading everything. But that's again, a different world for which I haven't yet found. But I'm sure it's there. I can't believe that these Winthrops weren't communicating across gender as well as across generation. Yeah.
I noticed that there are at least a couple of examples that you gave, one about Hebrew, another about Arabic. And I noticed actually the Arabic was well written. I wonder, do we have a phenomenon like Christian Hebraist here in America during this period? And what about Arabic?
Very little Arabic, but Hebrew, sure. You couldn't be a minister without studying Hebrew. So all the boys at Harvard studied Hebrew. Yale, when Yale opened, they taught Hebrew. So yeah, Hebrew would have been enough Hebrew to read the Bible would have been part of the basic curriculum. Sorry?
Not being
a real Hebraist. There's a good book. But there's a good book by Shalom Goldman on the study of Hebrew in the colonies, which shows that it really gets going. There's a lot of elementary study, but the kind of serious study European Christians were doing comes a bit later.
I think we have time for one more question. I have one.
Oh, great.
Something that theater historians would have loved to have somewhere else.
Well, I love Andy Stouffer's Book Traces project, which looks for marginalia not in books we call rare, but in 19th century women poets, for example, and finds the most amazing things in them. So I think we've become a lot more conscious of copy-specific knowledge of all kinds. That started with the analytical bibliography that told you that hand-press books are one-off and each one is probably different from the rest. The question is what we're going to do about it. Because in fact, the sheer quantity of material is so enormous that mapping it, cataloging it, storing it, accessing it all pose huge problems. And particularly as more and more libraries are taking their main stock of older books and sticking them somewhere off campus where they're pretty inaccessible, including my own, because we buy 5 miles of new books every year, and the new books come into the library, and there isn't room to keep the old ones. So I think the situation is a very precarious one. We're much more conscious that a badly bound 19th century book in Buckram may turn out to have some extraordinary human historical document in it, in turn a diary written in the margins of Felicia Hayman's, for example. There are a lot of those. And yet at the same time, those books are becoming harder to access than they would have been 50 years ago. There was a recent post on US Intellectual History, which is a really good blog, by someone saying, you can buy all the books you need to be an intellectual historian of 20th century America at library sales for about 25 cents each. It's, all of these wonderful books that the libraries are deaccessioning. I didn't know quite how to feel about that. But I do think that libraries are more aware of this. Princeton was a relatively poor library. Princeton, it's hard to remember this now, had no money until about 1900 when Woodrow Wilson invented the funding drive, which we have since exported to the rest of the academic world with such success. And so our library was poorer than Yale's or Harvard's, and that had one nice result, which was that a lot of times they got annotated copies because that was the cheapest copy going. The University of Illinois, which bought very heavily and incunabula down into the 50s, has lots and lots of annotated incunabula where the Huntington and the Library of Congress have beautiful clean ones. And actually the one in Illinois is a lot more interesting and it cost half as much. So if Krauss had some sort of ugly one that somebody had scrawled all over, he would sell it to Urbana. Now that seems much more interesting than the beautiful ones. So this has changed. I once had a book dealer tell me I had earned him tens of thousands of dollars by raising the value of annotated books. Again, I wasn't sure how I felt about that. And we are building these fascinating mosaics out of them. My own feeling is that they really work best when they're in a context. I mean, as Stouffer's are in a context of a hugely diffused kind of reading, or in the case of someone like Logan, where you've got correspondence and his own publications and the books, and you can make a three-dimensional story out of it. That for me, is the richest. But I do worry about how we'll ever figure out a way of even cataloging annotated books. How do you catalog annotated books well enough that people will actually find them off the digital searches? I don't think there's as yet much agreement about what that takes or how to do it. So, it's an interesting but not an altogether promising moment. On the other hand, we do have this, it does appear that annotations are infectious. Generations of younger scholars seem to have caught this passion, and so in that sense at least, I think the study will go on. As we used to say in the 60s, you end, the movement doesn't end, you end.